lost in my virtue, the goblet has passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. I'm feeding my ego again. Whisper their praises. They're nursing me now with their sweet empty phrases. The critics are cleaved from my peace with the mallet. No spoils are received by the king's fragile palate. Stuffing myself on the blind adulation. Head full of self, it's intense mastication. The simpleton's choir has taken its place. Accolades spewing from each vacant face. Now let's say praise. Toasting my virtue, the goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my ego again. The goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my ego, toasting my virtue. The goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end.
I gave you the anthem of the radio commentator, announcing person, which I have dubbed to be the official anthem as such. Hi, folks. I'm Ren Tawil. This is the Mideast Madness Show, coming to you live from Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Before I get any more into the show, I'm going to remind people again, beseeching them to give us a break here and keep our service and this show going ad infinitum. We need your donations. Yes, just like everybody else. Please send as much as you can, as often as you can, to the following address, FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Again, the address for those of you running to get your pens and papers, FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, two words, California, zip code 95061. I'll give you the telephone lines now. Area code 831-427-3772. That's line one, live to me here in the studio, 831-427-3772. And line number two, likewise, area code 831-469-3119. That's line number two, 469-3119. Now just be sure that my ringers are on. We're looking good there. Okay. Mideast Madness is this commentator's and DJ's take on the situation between Palestinians and Israelis, including those Palestinians also referred to by some as Israeli Arabs within the Green Line, inside Israel proper. For what it's worth, I do recognize the State of Israel, but I don't think too many people are going to get my permission on that or even listen. But I am indeed a Palestinian American. My father was born and raised in Jerusalem. I was brought up as a Lutheran. Dad came here to California, met my mother, and raised a family, including me. But I have not forgotten my roots. And in pursuing this whole thing about the Middle East, all of my adult life, really, at least remaining aware of what's going on, and then delving particularly over the last couple of years more intensely, I feel duty bound to host this program for all to hear. And by the way, Mideast Madness reruns are available at radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit four, the number four, all, radioforall.net. Just look for Mideast Madness and download the program of your choice. Flash. Israel vows to use veto power if Chuck Hagel is confirmed as United States Secretary of Defense. From The Onion, January 8. Jerusalem. Top-ranking government officials in Jerusalem confirmed Tuesday that Israel would exercise its long-standing constitutionally granted veto power over American policy if U.S. lawmakers confirmed retired Congressman Chuck Hagel as the United States' next Secretary of Defense. In light of Mr. Hagel's worrying remarks on Israeli-Palestinian relations and questionable classification of Israeli interests as, quote, the Jewish lobby, we consider him a highly inappropriate choice for Defense Secretary who stands far out of line with our national priorities. And therefore, we are prepared to swiftly and resolutely use our official veto power over this U.S. action, said Israeli government spokesperson Mark Regev of the legal maneuver that the small Middle Eastern nation has employed to block U.S. cabinet nominees, U.S. legislation, U.S. international relations, and U.S. domestic policy over 1,400 times in its 64-year history. He continues, because Congress does not possess the necessary 9/10 majority to override an Israeli veto, they'll have no choice but to head back to the drawing board and provide a defense secretary whom we find more suitable. End quote. Sources confirm that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had sent the White House a list of three individuals the Israeli leader considered appropriate to head the American military from which U.S. President Barack Obama could choose. The Onion. Okay, so it's not so recent. A news flash is dated January 8th. But it's important. Folks, again, I am not pretending that this show is even an attempt to be an objective analysis of the Middle East conflict. I'm a Palestinian American. My name is Ren Tawil. Tawil is Arabic for tall or long. Tawil is also an element in classic Arabic poetry. And the show is called Mideast Madness. Obviously, I have my bias. You're going to hear it here. This is something from The Undaunted Dove, which is the newsletter of Santa Cruz, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILPF. The Undaunted Dove. And it is published online at WILPF. That's WILPF.GOT.NET. It's definitely not GOV, GOT.net. A regular column by Margaret Knight, reports of the Middle East cluster. Actually, the column is entitled Shalom, Salam, Peace, reports of the Middle East cluster. Let me just make sure we're recording here. Looks good. I shall continue. Okay, very good. Conflict between Jews and Arabs is fairly recent. For centuries, Jews were persecuted in Christian Europe and found sanctuary in Arab lands. According to Islamic law, Jews and Christians are protected peoples, allowed to live in their own communities under their own laws. When the British took over Palestine after the First World War in 1922, the population was about 78% Muslim, 11% Jewish, and 10% Christian. In February 1919, British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour wrote Walter Rothschild, a member of the Rothschild banking family and the leading Zionist in Britain, saying Britain favored a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Let me add a comment here. She says in February 1919, Balfour wrote Rothschild, saying Britain favored a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Well, she may be right or wrong about that particular year, but it was 2 years prior, in 1917, when the ballyhooed Balfour Declaration was written and presented, 1917. Anyway, continuing. Britain favored a Jewish homeland in Palestine, provided that home can be given them without either dispossessing or oppressing the present inhabitants. That is a direct quote. Writing to the British Prime Minister a few months later, Balfour wrote, "In Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country. I do not think that Zionism will hurt the Arabs, but they will never say they want it." That was Balfour who said that. A generation before, in 1897, Theodore Herzl, founder of Zionism, wrote of a future Zionist state, "We shall try to spirit the penniless population of Palestine across the border by procuring employment for them in the transit countries while denying any employment in our country. This is Hertzell talking, folks. I added that. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly, end quote. This seems to be the first enunciation of the transfer policy. David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, wrote in 1937, and I quote, "We must expel the Arabs and take their places, and if we have to use force to guarantee our own right to settle in those places, then we have force at our disposal," end quote. And again, quote, "I support compulsory transfer. I do not see in it anything immoral. The Arabs will have to go, but one needs an opportune moment for making it happen, such as a war," end quote. I will be making some clarifying comments on this article when I'm done, by the way. Continuing. Nor did the United Nations consult the Arabs in 1947 when it partitioned Palestine and created the State of Israel. Today, the total Jewish and Arab populations of Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights, which really belong to Syria, I add, are nearly equal. Again, today, the total Jewish and Arab populations of Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights are nearly equal. I think by that she means Arabs to Israelis. Continuing, should the solution to the Arab problem be one state where Jews will soon be a minority, or two states? In 2011, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, quote, "I have no wish to annex them, Arabs, into Israel. I want to separate from them so that they will not be Israeli citizens. I am interested that there will be a solid Jewish majority inside the state of Israel," end quote. In retaliation to United Nations recognition of Palestine as a non-member observer state, Netanyahu authorized 3,000 new housing units on Palestinian land between Jerusalem and the large settlement of Ma'ale Adumim. This would extend Israeli control to the Jordan Valley, almost bisecting the West Bank. Netanyahu rejects a one-state solution, but makes a contiguous Palestinian state almost impossible. Again, that was written by Margaret Knight, a regular columnist in the Undaunted Dove. And this is the January 2013 issue. Since this is my show, my sentiment, my bias, I'm going to add my comments. Knight begins by pointing out the conflict between Jews and Arabs is fairly recent. Granted, there have been two or three major historical instances going back since before the time of Muhammad, since even before the time of Christ, where these two Semitic-speaking peoples were in conflict. But most likely nothing like this 20th and 21st century thing that's going on. The important thing is Knight is pointing out that over the last couple of millennia, conflict between Jews and Arabs was quite rare. As she says, for centuries, Jews were persecuted in Christian Europe and found sanctuary in Arab lands. Okay, so according to Islamic law, Jews and Christians are protected peoples, allowed to live in their own communities under their own laws. They are referred to as people of the book, referring to the Holy Scriptures, the Torah, the Talmud, the Old Testament, which is also called the Old Covenant. But that being according to the Quran, the writings of Muhammad in the holy book of the Islamic people. Now, if this is true, why then do we keep hearing about the Muslim communities, the Muslim world communities, vow to kill all the Jews? Why do we hear about their vows to obliterate Israel? The very first thing I'm going to say about that is, keep in mind, I am not a Muslim, nor have I ever been a Muslim. I was raised Christian. And I am rather non-religious by this point. But I am spiritual. Okay, the second thing is, what Knight says about Islamic law and the protection of Jews and Christians is true. But apparently there are other writings in the Quran, the holy Islamic scripture of the Quran, that there are instances, either at the time of the person reading it or perhaps sometime in the future, where it is all right to wage war against others, including Jews. I have not read the Quran, only snippets here and there. But I would say this is a kind of current phenomenon. There are Palestinian Arabs who have been displaced forcibly. And none of this nonsense about radio broadcasts in 1948 from their own people advising the Palestinian Arabs to take a vacation and come back into Palestine, come back to your towns and villages and your homes after we have eradicated the Jews. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm saying that that was a very minor factor in the creation of the Palestinian refugee problem of 1948. And didn't happen at all in 1967 when the second half of the Palestinian refugee problem was created. So so what am I getting at? It's really unfortunate now that, in my opinion, that the Muslims are up in arms in terms of expressing these sentiments in their charters and in announcements. But folks, I'm going to be honest with you. I have a real hard time arguing with them. That does not mean that I'm going to run out, pick up a rifle or an artillery piece and join the cause. It means when you have 1.8 million Palestinian Gazans in the Gaza Strip who are denied, who many of whose children are denied true nutritional sustenance because the Israelis monitor and control access going in and out of the Gaza Strip, when they don't have spare parts for their hospitals, for their dialysis machines that I personally inspected when I was there, when they can't get spare parts or proper machinery and tools for maintaining and repairing their infrastructure, which causes great amounts of pollutants to go untreated into the sea, and you cannot keep the little kids from swimming in the sea. I've seen them do that too. They've been known to come out of the ocean. By the time they come out of the water, they're already starting to be, their skin is already showing signs of scoring, of scabs. Coloration and decoloration. That's because of the pollution. The Israelis know about this situation, but they try to convince the world that there is, and they say so in so many words, quote, there is no humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip, end quote. That's what the Israelis say and what the IDF says. IDF is Israeli Defense forces, which is really the IOF, the Israeli occupation forces. May as well call them offensive forces, in my mind. And, of course, the situation in the West Bank also, likewise, gives those Arabs, those Palestinians, no reason to trust Israel to make a decent peace with justice for them. These 3,000 units of housing that Knight mentions they were in the works to begin with, but of course Netanyahu used his announcement and actually said at the time something to the effect of, this amounts to punishment of the West Bank Palestinians for seeking status in the world community as a state to some degree or another. And again, the UN pronounced Palestine as a non-member observer state. Retaliation from the Prime Minister of Israel. I mean, does that even make any sense? Because a native peoples of Palestine actively make it happen in conference with the United Nations that they are now a non-member observer state because they have political aspirations of their own, expressions of self-determination, Netanyahu is going to punish them. He's going to retaliate. Does it even make sense? And the weird thing is, not very many people in the United States seem to bat an eye at that. At his deed, at the wording of his deed, and at the fact that this oppresses the Palestinians even more. So as I was saying, I cannot argue with Hamas in Gaza when that government says, or it can be interpreted from their charter, that the Jews will continue to be their enemy, the Arabs' enemy, the Palestinians' enemy. And Hamas takes it on to themselves to make this decree in their charter. Oh, it is militant. I don't deny that. It's a militant statement and a militant stance. In terms of PR, it certainly doesn't help the cause of the Palestinian Arabs. Then again, I repeat, I don't see that Israel has given legitimate reason for the Arabs to expect decent treatment, decent consideration, or being afforded their own state, especially with Israel continuing to increase these Jewish settlements in the West Bank, just as they did in Gaza before they gave those up. Just as Herzl said in 1897, in Rothschild in Great Britain, around the early 20s, and so many other Jewish leaders, including rabbis, a number of rabbis, as they do today, since Herzl's time, have advocated, have pushed for what they call the transfer of Arabs outside of Palestine. Transfer, of course, is a euphemism, a polite way of saying, if you can even call it polite, of saying, throw them out, get rid of them, expel them. It's, folks, it's in the Zionist documents, as I read here from Knight's article. This, reading this article is by no means the first time that I've heard this stuff. I knew about this when I was, I think before I was even 20. Don't forget the phone lines, folks. I think everything is functioning technically well enough for you to call in. Area code 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. The second line is same area code, 831-469-3119. If I'm using any big words here that you're not familiar with, if you want to know what is meant by Zionism or Zionist, if you want to know more about Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, or Ben-Gurion, if you have any questions like that, you'll have to call me to find out, because I need to know if anyone's listening. Okay. I'm going to read you another brief blurb here. This is... There's a marvelous organization, one of many, many, many like-minded organizations. Whose membership is predominantly Jewish. It's called Jewish Voice for Peace. Jewish Voice for Peace is utterly hated in many quarters in Israel and among the American Jewish community in the United States. They are despised. Why? Because Jewish Voice for Peace, people who by no means hate themselves for being Jewish, they see the threat against Judaism, against the Jewish faith, that Israel is and has been for decades pursuing. They see Israel as pushing policies which will at its worst only bring the destruction of Israel from the inside. In other words, for all the talk that the Jews in historical Palestine generate about how, oh, the Arabs are going to murder us all, they're going to destroy us. They use the word destroy and destruction so often in that context. The Israelis say the Arabs are going to destroy us. Not going to happen, folks. As my dear friend Lauren Booth puts it, not going to happen. Militarily, no one can even phase Israel. The closest the Arabs came to doing that was in 1973 when Egypt tried, rightfully in my view, to take back their Sinai Peninsula from the Israelis and ended up with only a sliver of it after armistice talks. And likewise, Syria tried to take back the Golan and ended up only with a tiny sliver of that. That's militarily, that is the worst that the IDF and the people of Israel have ever had to face in terms of a threat from outside. But as Abraham Lincoln said in his second inaugural speech, or maybe it was his first, at any rate, and no, I did not hear this from the National Geographic Channel's Killing Lincoln, which was displayed last night on TV. In an inaugural address, Abe Lincoln pointed out that no army from Europe or South America or Asia could, as he put it, forcibly take a drink from the Ohio or hold a mountaintop on the Blue Ridge Mountains. He was emphasizing that militarily we are secure here in the United States. But Lincoln followed that up immediately by saying, in fact, the only threat to our existence as a free people will come from inside the U.S. in the form of militantism, militarism. The kind of thing that, frankly, many militias and militia types in the U.S. today who are hiding out in the mountains and valleys and deserts and far away are piping up about. That people are going to rebel against the IRS, the tax payment people, tax takers people. The point is, Lincoln says that we can only, from lack of vigilance, we can lose our freedom from within the U.S. I say the same thing applies to Israel. And until they get their act together and begin to realize that there is never going to be an absolute 100% Jewish peopled population of Israel, at least not without killing or transferring every last non-Jewish but current citizen of Israel, and unless the people of Israel come to realize that there is a lot of mythology which has been generated and pushed for years and years and years over there amongst their own people about who was really attacked and who the true aggressors are, if Israel is, if this realization is not, does not come about among the governments, the various governments of Israel, then they may be doomed. They may be dooming themselves. Okay, getting back to before all this talk about Lincoln and stuff. And it is 3:40 p.m. here in Santa Cruz County, California. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. Streaming live on the internet at freakradio.org. Still waiting for phone calls, folks. That includes you, Connect 741. I hope I got those digits right. Or for that matter, Tom Trento. You can call me, too, if you're not busy. Okay, Jewish Voice for Peace and like-minded organizations consider themselves to be good Jews and, in many cases, good Israelis who are acting for the good of Israel and its citizens by challenging current policy in Israel. The current state of legal inequality between Jews and Arabs, Israel's Israeli Arabs, the disparations in employment and income, and infrastructure of the towns, many of them ghettoized, of the Palestinians. Jewish Voice for Peace is very vocal about the truth of what's going on out there. And this is why they are disdained so much by various Israelis. Here is an obvious attempt to garner donations, money donations to their organization. She titles it, "I Did It, So Can You." She writes to me with her automatic robo-writing thingies. "Dear Ren, this is what I know. Each of us has the power to change. And when we do, the world changes too." She says, "I know this because I changed. My name is Rebecca Subar, and I'm the board chair of Jewish Voice for Peace. It's a role that would have seemed ridiculous 30 years ago when I was living as a settler in Gaza. I grew up in a warm, strictly observant Jewish family in Western New York. When I was 8, we first visited my cousins in a farm village north of Tel Aviv, and my senses remember it best, jasmine and singing on a truck ride to the sea. I was a teenager in the 70s, and for the most part, the hippest causes matched my family's values. They cared about racial injustice, education reform, and ending war. My first political troublemaking was on behalf of Israel, trying to get my synagogue youth group in line with the new West Bank Jewish settler movement. It was the edgy, exciting ways to live a political dream, and I thought the right thing to do. Alas, I learned it was not so simple. This is Rebecca Subar, Board Chair of Jewish Voice for Peace, speaking. In 1982, I went with my own young family to live my dream of being part of the settlement movement. Our lives were deeply entwined with our love for Jewish everything. The spring we were there, Ariel Sharon, then Israel's Minister of Agriculture, came to speak at the groundbreaking for the new regional yeshiva, a house of study. Jewish protesters came, leftists opposed the new settlements. One of them approached me, to my surprise, someone I recognized, Michael, a friend from home. He asked, "Rebecca, you can't seriously be part of this injustice, can you? Do you know there are Palestinians living down the road and this is their land?" It made my head spin. How could we be doing anything unjust? Justice was something our people did. Settling our land was justice. Our community was good to our Arab neighbors. Our rabbis talked with their sheikhs. Michael's comment was so off, so wrong. But my friend had planted a seed that day, a seed that racked my head and made painful space for new information and new doubts. In a brief space of time, these doubts and my deeper down belief in equality and fairness occupied my entire awareness and prompted me to fundamentally change my life. So you could say I am living proof that people change. People have the power and responsibility to live into the change they believe in, to speak their truths in orders that others, and so the world, can change too. I am part of Jewish Voice for Peace because this organization gives me the tools and the courage to be the person, like my friend Michael all those years ago, who says, "You've got to live your beliefs, Rebecca." The sweet smell of jasmine still tugs at my memories, and I still sing the beautiful old songs with my family. They are an important part of my history, just as justice is, not just for my family, my neighbors, my people, but for everyone who shares this planet. For Palestinians and for Jews, equally. And then Rebecca Subar ends saying, "Thank you for reading, thank you for donating, thank you for singing and for joining me in honoring our mutual belief in justice for all people. Sincerely, Rebecca Subar, Board Chair, Jewish Voice for Peace." That was a rerun article. I have read that before. Not an article, but a request for funds. I copied it and made it a point to read it more than once on Mideast Madness, because I really appreciate the, not just the sentiment of what she's saying, but the candidness of her as a Jewish woman. Again, the phone numbers are 8314-273772, 8314-693119. Don't be shy, even if you're quite sure that you don't know enough about the topic to justify calling and risking in fear that you may make a fool of yourself. I promise that I will do my very best to not let you become a fool on the air. I will be respectful, particularly if you reciprocate with like respectability, like respectfulness. Okay, I know it's really easy to get tired of hearing my voice. Another musical break, and once again, here's Stuart Davis singing Universe Communion.
There was a star that was hidden in space, an undiscovered gem. Death's innocence decided they had chosen the Dagon to give the gift to them. The shocking revelations of a primitive people, our knowledge was redefined. Enlightened and wise, a simple African tribe has educated the modern minds. Our potential's choked under the scientific yoke. Afraid that if we move and open our eyes, we'll have to realize that if a message from a distant sun can reach us, there is a magic that is waiting and is willing to teach us.
Yo, phone line number one. Howdy, this is Ren. You're on the air.
Hey, Ren, it's Uncle Dennis. Just wanted to let you know I'm going to be coming by the studio in a minute.
Okay. I thought
all right,
it might...
See you then.
Bye. It's all right, folks. It's Uncle Dennis. And if you're a regular listener, you would have a better idea who Uncle Dennis is. I'll continue with the musical break and go unlock the door.
This arena of Western thought, the spirit is in a vice. We're driven to seek, but it's a futile pursuit with the means that won't suffice. It is a science with a limited scope, where the heart and head collide. Designed to the laws of only tangible proof, to which the truth does not abide. We stifle and smother the mystic wonder. Or is our arrogance a deafening fear of what we'll have to hear? But if a message from a distant sun can reach us, that is waiting and is willing to teach us how to suture every soul in the one concentric whole. Earth will find a perfect union in a universe communion. There's a tendency to think that it's the practical sense get these questions solved. It's the tenuous tools, and the more we employ them, the slower that we evolve. Denied by suppression, perfect union in a universe communion.
trophy inside you. The mystic ocean is pristine. It is the spirit realm, and you are at the helm, where all the hungry souls convene. Your instruments are gauge for motion. Don't tie the craft, you'll keep it still. Rip the captain's idol, then the ship is bright. Oh, you have a voyage to fulfill. This vessel harbors no one meek, timid never seek. You watch the water rise, and you have anxious eyes. There is a compass in your chest. There is a purpose you possess. Every drop and every crest. I know your sails are full and tight. I see you toward the house of light. Some may embrace their hesitations with the passive anchors that they lay, but retrospect will prove those who never move become a pirate's easy prey. This boat is the sum of all your actions. Its body is a product of your deeds. Crossing water fast, ambition is the mast. You were christened with Godspeed. The frightened ones who wouldn't board envy you from shore. Rising tide, you are in your eyes. There is a compass in your chest. There is a purpose you possess. With every drop and every crest, I see your sails are full and tight. I see you toward the house of light. By a dimmer glow, drown in the undertow. But you are centered in a higher conscious wind. You see the beacon clear and bright. There is a compass in your chest. There is a purpose you possess. With every drop and every crest, I see your sails are full and tight. Pressing toward the house of light.
There's a purpose you possess.
Pressing toward the house of light. With every drop and every crest, I see sails are full and tight.
Pressing toward the house of light.
I had my stomach pumped two times my senior year, which earned the approbation of all my plastered peers. Now I do my weekly bleeding at trendy AA meetings. I was a social monster, but now I serve my sponsor. I choke out cliche confessions. I suck down coffee black and I chain smoke cigarettes in between handfuls of Prozac. Man, in my one sober stallion, I just got my first medallion. My higher power drugged me, I'm letting strangers hug me. And now I really crave a meeting, all those soothing empty greetings. The big book is omniscient, and I'm not self-sufficient. Dependency's still coursing through my blood, I'm only changing drugs. Self-help study, 12-step program, which hollow slogan was it? We found serenity, and day by day or easy does it. Plant that affirmation seed, our license plate should read 10,000 lakes and treatment centers.
ready for a statewide mentor. They say the devil's in the details of this cunning, baffling habit. I poured out all my NyQuil, I flushed my sonic tablets. Don't take others' inventory, thanks for sharing your sick story. My love, I know they'll call it, I'm Stuart, I'm an alcoholic. Dysfunction breeds the strangest sages, quoting pointless daily phrases. The big book is our mission, and I'm not self-sufficient. Dependency still coursing through my blood, I'm only changing drugs. Self-perpetuating business, you can't cure a lifelong sickness. Hazelden cleaned out my parents, but my stay was 14 karat. Inner peace is what we see, 1500 bucks a week. Treatment's just a new psychosis, need and weakness through hypnosis. The big book is our mission, and I'm not self-sufficient. Dependency still coursing through my blood, I'm only changing.
And folks, it is 1600 hours here on the west coast of North America. That's 4 p.m. for all you lay people. No, that's not a dirty thing to say. Still waiting for Dennis to show up here. I'm trying to prepare a microphone for him here. Test. Hello, can you hear me in this microphone? I guess it would help if I turned up the other. Hello. Okay, it works. Just got to figure out which knob it is here. It's got to be... looks like it's... Well, it happens to be on... Mic 4. No, it's... Okay, it works. That's the important thing. That's the really important thing. Of course, Dennis may not say anything at all to us. He may be coming in for maintenance purposes. Or pick up the wallet with $300 in cash that he left here on the big board. 402. Let me turn up my... Okay, 402, people.
Can you hear me now? Can you? Okay.
Let's continue. Yalo. Let us continue with Mideast Madness. And... Now that means getting to my mail. Oh, by the way, please don't forget, if for any reason you have any message you want to send me, a question, a shout out, if you want to curse me down, if that's how you get your jollies and make yourself feel powerful, you can send a message via email. A wonderful feature of the computer, internet, world wide web. MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's the web address for this show. Just all one word, Mideast Madness. Take care. It's not Middle East Madness. It's Mideast Madness at G as in God, M as in Mighty, X as in Xylophone. .com. I know I have to find some more interesting words to help spell out gmx.com. from my man, MJ Rosenberg. This is the gentleman who posts on the website Media with Conscience, MWC. His name is MJ Rosenberg. This is the guy who also used to work for AIPAC. That's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which in my mind is really the American-Israel Political Action Committee, or Propaganda Action Committee might be a little more accurate. A very powerful lobby, rivaled only by the National Rifle Association in Washington, D.C. Rosenberg used to work for AIPAC. Then he became enlightened and quit. Or maybe they let him go. I don't know the details. But this is a man who cannot keep his mouth shut, cannot stop writing. MJ Rosenberg, February 8th of this year, 2013. Imagine no Israel lobby. Hi. Do you want to talk?
Not really.
Okay. Dennis is here, so all is well. I leave whatever important work he's doing in his good hands. We shall continue.
Posting our dues report.
Yeah.
Now the minutes of our meeting are gone. All our pictures are gone.
Isn't that what Albert reported to us in one of his emails? He said all the posters were gone. I wasn't sure what he meant by posters. What is going on here?
Yeah, there were posters. We had historic posters from.
Maybe they moved into the new studio space.
I don't know.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, a lot of nice pictures are gone too. Pictures of people that aren't, you know, former programmers. All that. It's really sad.
It is sad.
Sure, like no one happened. Have a good show, Ron.
Okay. Thank you. I'll leave the door unlocked in case he forgets something and needs to come back. He called 10 minutes ago. He just wanted me to unlock the door. Well, I had a chance. Okay, getting back to the MJ Rosenberg article. Most likely from his blog. Entitled, Imagine No Israel Lobby. I was watching John Brennan's Senate hearing and suddenly the words to the John Lennon song Imagine came into my head with a slight twist. Imagine there's no lobby. It's easy if you try. No memorized talking points. No need to lie. With my apologies to Lennon's wonderful singing voice. I'm in good company when I contemplate a world without AIPAC. Upon his election as Prime Minister in 1992, Yitzhak Rabin told the lobby that Israel would be better off without it and that it did more harm than good. He wanted AIPAC out of the way because he was planning a peace initiative with the Palestinians and knew that AIPAC would try, as it did, to thwart his efforts. Now, isn't that a fascinating revelation? I'm going to read that whole paragraph again. I'm in good company when I contemplate a world without AIPAC. Upon his election as Prime Minister in 1992, Yitzhak Rabin told the lobby, AIPAC, that Israel would be better off without it and that it did more harm than good. This is the Prime Minister of Israel talking now. He wanted AIPAC out of the way because he was planning a peace initiative with the Palestinians and knew that AIPAC would try, as it did, to thwart his efforts. Rosenberg's article continues now. Of course, Rabin's effort to eliminate AIPAC failed. He was, after all, only the Prime Minister of Israel. And AIPAC is AIPAC, an institution dedicated to preserving its own power, not Israel's security. Rabin was dedicated to working with the United States government to advance peace, not organizing billionaires to thwart U.S. goals. The reason I was contemplating an alternate universe without the Israel lobby was that I was struck by the contrast between a John Brennan's hearing in which Israel was not an issue, hence no lobby involvement, and one in which there seemed to be no other issue, and Chuck Hagel's. In fact, neither hearing should have been about Israel, although both the heads of the Department of Defense and the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, have some involvement with Israel, the CIA director actually more, Israel is not a major concern of either one. Nonetheless, the Hagel hearing was almost entirely about Israel, while Brennan's was about CIA policies, largely drone strikes and interrogation practices. I admit that I am overstating my case when I say that absent the Israel lobby, there is no need for a public official to lie. I believe that most public officials lie when they consider it necessary to defend themselves, the bad policies they've implemented, or their superiors. For some, lying is an autonomic response to pretty much any question. One small example. Did you ever see an executive or legislative branch official refuse to answer a question by saying that he hasn't read a particular report? That is almost always a lie. If a reporter knows about it, the official in question almost surely does too. And just because the lobby was not looking over Brennan's shoulder when he testified about drones and torture, there is no way he was always telling the complete truth. Again, I am reading from a blog article by Mr. A.J. Rosenberg, who I like. Continuing. But most of the time, Brennan and the senators were free to engage in a serious discussion of the issues based on what both the nominee and the legislators believe is for the United States. Although, depending on one's view, either Brennan or the senators, or both, were terribly wrong, it would be hard to argue that their positions were dictated by a lobby and that lobby's ability to deliver campaign funding. The Hagel hearing, on the other hand, wasn't really a hearing at all. For the senators, it was just an opportunity to audition in front of current or potential donors. Yes, this man is cynical. He continues, it was like getting a speaking role at the AIPAC annual conference, an opportunity to demonstrate that a legislator was 100% for whatever the lobby is for. The worst thing was that a hearing about leading the Pentagon barely touched on any of the issues that affect America's military. So eager were the senators to suck up to the lobby by proclaiming undying devotion to Israel that they barely mentioned the 1.5 million Americans on active duty and all the problems they face. Nor was there much interest expressed in the current war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq, or about when the use of military force is warranted and when it isn't. No, it was all about Israel. Actually, not so much Israel as the Israel lobby. What, other than the desire to please the lobby, could have made Senator Kristen Gillibrand, Democrat from New York, ask for Hagel's commitment that Israel's aid package would be exempt from sequestration cuts, unlike all the programs that actually affect her constituents? Now, let me read that again because we're getting into some Senate political fancy words here. we're getting into some the nomenclature of the operations of the U.S. Congress again. No, it was all about Israel. Actually, not so much Israel as the Israel lobby. What, other than the desire to please the lobby, could have made Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat from New York, ask for Hagel's commitment that Israel's aid package would be exempt from sequestration cuts, unlike all the programs that actually affect her constituents? But her pandering to AIPAC was typical, replicated by such other lobby devotees as Lindsey Graham, a Republican senator of South Carolina, who histrionically read from a lobby script attesting to the lobby's non-existence and demanded that Hagel apologize for ever suggesting that there is such a thing as the GASP, quote, Jewish lobby, end quote. Graham, no special fan of Israel, is concerned about a challenge from a Tea Party candidate in 2014 and is eager to raise money from AIPAC-associated donors to help him withstand the challenge. Of course, Gillibrand is from New York, but that barely matters anymore. She, like her Republican colleagues, Graham, Ted Cruz of Texas, Roy Blunt of Missouri, David Vitter of Louisiana, and Mike Lee of Utah, she was playing for money, not votes. National money. Although the Republicans know that lobby donors are unlikely to support right-wing Republicans, they also know, as Jesse Helms discovered, that enthusiastic pandering to AIPAC will make it harder for their Democratic opponents to raise money. Not when, to use AIPAC's term, the Republican incumbent is a, quote, staunch supporter, end quote, of Netanyahu. Rosenberg continues to say, in short, the Hagel hearing was a nauseating spectacle. By comparison, but only by comparison, the Brennan hearing was a textbook example of American democracy at its best. Sure, there were lobbyists in the room, but they didn't write the script. Yes, some of the positions Brennan and some of the senators took are truly appalling, and some senators made no sense at all. Nonetheless, the Brennan hearing was not a fundraiser. It was about issues, even principles and morality. The difference, of course, was the absence of the lobby. Imagine. M.J. Rosenberg, Post Office Box 76283, Washington, D.C., zip code 20013, or perhaps more easily for most of us, mail to, listen carefully and get your pens and papers out, M.J.A.Y. Rosenberg Blog. Again, that's M.J.A.Y. R.O.S.E.N.B.E. R-G-B-L-O-G, M.J. Rosenberg Blog, @gmail.com, @mail127.us2.mcsv.net. And that should work as I spelled it to you because it's underlined and all set to be clicked upon. To link to Mr. Rosenberg if you want to give a response. Okay, enough of the technical details. That's, again, J. Rosenberg is a good Jewish, good American individual who has been converted, has seen the light, gotten religion, as it were, and wants to let the world know that the power of AIPAC and other strident American Jewish organizations, which may be more interested in their own survival and well-being than in Israel's survival and well-being, should not have so much pull and not near so much attention made to them. It's 419, 1619 hours in Santa Cruz County, California. Who the hell are we? This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. You heard me right. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz. Free isn't free, but the website is freak, F-R-E-A-K, radio.org, freakradio.org. Just wanted to clear that up. Now, still no one wants to talk to me, apparently. I know what I'll do. Let's check the Shoutcast administrative site. And I can get some idea of who may be listening. If this computer weren't so damn slow, it would be a lot easier. It'd be a lot quicker to pull this stuff up. Yeah, I was really late today to the studio. I had to pick up my supplies, ergo food and drink, for today's session. Today's lectures, as it were. And don't forget, you can contact me if you don't want to call me today. Since I'm live at 4:21 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, you won't be able to call me during a rerun that you can find on radioforall.net on the Mideast Madness show. Then you can send a message to MideastMadness@gmx.com. Okay, Shoutcast Administrator. Shoutcast Administrator claims that around the world, and perhaps in the space station Alpha, there are a total of 4 listeners. Of course, it depends. That's according to the 128K stereo Shoutcast Administrator. 24K mono Shoutcast Administrator claims I won't even tell you that. Private 128K stereo Shoutcast Administrators. There's one person listening. We'll go with the one that has the most listeners. And that says 4. Of course, that's only people listening on their computers, folks. I have no way of telling how many roughly within the area of the city of Santa Cruz are listening on their old-fashioned radios. Okay, I can't even remember why I brought that up. What was I going to... Okay, let's get back to the other fascinating, fascinating article. Maybe I should stipulate no more music until people call me. Even if you've called me before, Robert in San Diego, I know you're out there. Perhaps you're listening again today. My friend Betty or Betsy, there's a couple of them out there. I beseech you to call me and make this show more interesting. Okay. Hey, folks, how about that? Another call. On phone line 1. Hello, you're on the air.
I am. I'm not hearing you on my car radio. And I was earlier. You were coming in really clear, and now I'm just getting static on the radio.
Where are you?
In downtown Santa Cruz near the town clock.
Hmm. You're in your car?
Yeah, on my car radio.
Well, it could be a downtown thing, you know. Sometimes the concrete canyons and their various accoutrements.
Oh, here
get
you
in
are. Okay, hold on. Okay, well, now that proves it. You are on the air, man. I don't know what that 18-minute gap was about. Maybe,
well, you go in and out of it, you know. The important thing is, you've been listening to the show for whatever period of time. What's your name, please?
I'm the infamous Becky.
Ah, thank you for calling, Becky.
Yes, and I've been meaning to call you for a bit because I know that you have a very vigorous agenda that you're talking about on your show. And
it is a sincere agenda. I'm not out to trash people for the sake of trashing them. I seek the truth and justice for all parties concerned, even if it is my own bias. Anyway, go ahead.
All right. Well, maybe I could just raise a couple issues with you and see if we can, you know, get some point counterpoint and see where we have common ground and where we're at loggerheads.
That sounds good.
I often hear Israel referred to as an apartheid state.
Yes.
And now that would be, of course, to compare Israel with the former government structure of South Africa,
yes,
the apartheid system, and make a comparison to those two government structures, correct?
Well, that's one way of looking at it, yes. Yes, I agree.
I don't see how that could possibly fit. Under apartheid in South Africa, 85% of the indigenous population were confined to 15% of the land. They weren't even allowed to get to go outside of that 15% after dark, and they had no voting rights. In Israel, 20% of the population is Arab Muslim, and they have no restrictions on their travel within the state of Israel. They can own property, they vote, they have full citizenship rights, and have representatives in the Knesset, which is the parliament for Israel. In fact, there's only one law, as far as I can tell, in the entire Israeli code book that differentiates between one group of peoples and another based on religion or ethnicity. And that is that Orthodox Jews and Muslims, who live within Israel are not required to serve. Service in the military is not compulsory. That's it. So how can you make a claim that Israel is an apartheid state?
How could I make the claim?
Well, you could say it's not right now, and we'll say, okay, we agree
okay.
on that point.
Okay, I'll try to take your questions more or less chronologically. Comparing South African, historical South African apartheid,
right,
since
South
it is
African
no more,
state.
To alleged Israeli apartheid against Palestinian Arabs.
I don't say alleged, really. Many, many groups, including the Resource Center for Nonviolence, have claimed that Israel is practicing apartheid.
Hmm.
Jimmy Carter came out with a book. The title of it was...
Peace.
You know, peace, not apartheid.
Peace, not apartheid.
So, you know, I don't know why you would back off from that as being something that is claimed regularly by people who feel that Israel is being unjust.
Actually, Jimmy Carter did make an apology to a small group of Jews in the United States, and sure enough, the media picked up on that incident. He, I didn't hear the apology, but apparently he was, he most likely versed this in terms of, I'm sorry if I've offended anyone. I didn't mean to come out and offend the sensibilities of people. So he did do that, but, you know, and
no, he went further. His apology actually said that there's no apartheid within the state of Israel.
Okay, then
his claim of apartheid had to do with the way Israel deals with the Palestinian territories.
Okay. Well, I haven't read the book.
I'm glad. I don't recommend the book. I think it was a very poor job on part of former President Carter, and that he doesn't even seem to have a clear grasp of history where he played a role.
Namely,
the signing of the 1979 peace treaty between Egypt and Israel.
It would surprise me that he doesn't have a clear grasp on the history. He's written so many books, including the Blood of Abraham, on the topic. And he spent a lot of time over there. He has observed elections among the Palestinians in various places and other countries. He certainly had a lot of exposure. At any rate, as I was saying, you can never make an exact comparison between the two apartheids. To some degree or another, it's apples and oranges. As far as the rights of Arabs, Palestinians who are referred to as Israeli citizens, you got to keep in mind, Israel takes a lot of pride, a lot of vocal pride, in the fact that it is a democracy. And they could never get away with calling themselves a democracy if they blatantly denied the vote to the indigenous Arabs, if they didn't have a few Arab or even Muslim judges on their courts, their superior courts. To make them look good, they're going to allow some of this stuff to happen, just like they allow...
To allow the Arab Muslim 20% of their population to vote? I think that the fact that there's free election, that no one is denied the right to vote, they have full equal rights of citizenship. That's not the case. It's not a publicity stunt.
That's what it amounts to. And they do not have complete equal rights in reality, the situation on the ground, as they like to call it, just because they have the right to vote. There's still ghettoization of large groups of Palestinians in some cities and villages where they do not get an adequate fair share of tax monies in order to improve their infrastructure, to help fight crime. I mean, there's a...
You're talking about within Israel, right?
Within Israel. And yes, there are...
All right, I'm sorry. I haven't really seen those articles, and...
I take it you've been to Israel, though.
Oh, I've never been to Israel.
Really?
No.
Well,
In a way, I'm neutral because I'm not Israeli, I'm not Jewish, I'm not Palestinian, I'm not Muslim, I'm not Arab. I really don't have a horse in this race. But I am a teacher, and I am a student of history, and I'm also in favor of the anti-war movement. Being that I think war is just a despicable practice that must be ended one way or another. And that's not really why I got involved in this issue. It had more to do with what I perceive as a thinly veiled anti-Semitism that runs through local groups like Sprint and Students for Justice in Palestine, the Muslim Student Association, the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which I mentioned before, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the local Green Party, the local Peace and Freedom Party.
I'm sorry,
these are all organizations that have a distinctly anti-Israel bias, that I believe borders on anti-Semitism, although...
Can you tell us why it borders on anti-Semitism? Can you tell? Is it Betsy or Betty? I'm sorry, I keep forgetting.
Is it neither. I'm Becky.
Becky. Hey, I'm really glad you've cleared us up, cleared me up about that. Becky, I won't say your last name on the air. A couple of questions. First of all, I've been given the impression that you are, if not an Israeli, are you Jewish?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I was raised Lutheran.
So was I.
And when I was 40, I converted to the Baha'i faith.
I see. Really?
If I have any connection to Israel, that would be it. That the Universal House of Justice is located in Haifa, Israel. And we believe, you know, and Baha'is are discriminated all across the Arab world, especially in Iran, but elsewhere as well. And the only safe place that the Baha'is could possibly have their Universal House of Justice is in the State of Israel, where religions are tolerated.
There's no question that there are good things about Israel, and there are traditions, some of which are based in Western philosophy, that run deep in Israel. That, of course, is because a great many Jews who have, over the past 125 years, populated Israel have come from Western countries, have come from Europe, and they have instituted...
All over the world, really.
And they have instituted their values in Israel.
You can find Jews from every country in the world in Israel. They're Jewish Argentinians, they're Jewish Brazilians, you know, they're Jewish. I don't know if there are any Jewish Eskimos, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were some Jewish Eskimos.
There are Chinese Jews, and I was told that by a dear Jewish friend of mine in Minnesota who had to take a class in order to find that out.
That's why the claim of apartheid is so ridiculous when you talk about Israel, because
we're talking about the territories. You admit
there's a diversity within the State of Israel that is you don't find that in any of the Arab countries around it. You don't find it in Saudi Arabia or Egypt. Or you know, more so in Lebanon, probably.
Okay, Becky, sorry. Forgive me, Becky. I consider you a friend. I'm not here to make enemies. And I'm not going to make the ridiculous claim that there are no such injustices in the Arab world. There are some terrible characteristics about, in my opinion, about the governments of the various Arab countries and about the philosophy that, quite frankly, I think is backwards. Part of the message I'm trying to get across here is people who support Israel, people who love Israel, don't make the mistake of hiding behind the Western values and partial democracy of Israel in making your comparisons. There are things about Israel that are, in some aspects, even worse than, in my opinion, again, than the various Arab countries. None of these guys should get away with that. And as someone with Palestinian heritage, I choose to give attention to the so-called Palestinian question or the Palestinian problem. That phrase reminds me of the Indian problem when the white man was trying to decide what to do about the Indians, the Native Americans. It was sometimes versed as the Indian problem or the Cheyenne problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're indigenous peoples. We're talking about indigenous peoples.
Well, the Jewish problem was, you know, a very common phrase in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah. And they weren't, it wasn't at all that they were necessarily a problem per se. They were a problem for someone who considered themselves above the Jews or above the American Indians or above the Palestinians. Anyway, you've already admitted that apartheid, according to Jimmy Carter's publication, really was addressing the situation in the territories in the West Bank and Gaza.
What he said.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what we're left to here in Northern California when we're trying to interpret this situation from afar and try to ferret out what the truth of the situation is, because there's certainly hot tempers on both sides of this issue.
We do. It is imperative that we strive to get rid of the emotionalism on this issue. And now,
we used the term a little bit ago called indigenous Arab population. Mm-hmm. I have to take issue with that. The true indigenous population would be the Jews, in terms of, if you go back historically, who of the people that are with us in modern time, who goes back the furthest to the land? And I'd say the Jewish claims to the land far exceed those of Muslims or Arabs. Or Palestinians, actually. You know, you say that you're a Palestinian by ancestry.
That's correct.
But
I also hold a Palestinian passport, by the way.
The Palestinians are a modern people. They only really started to congeal as a separate national people after the 1967 war.
Do you think that the
identified as Arabs.
I'm going to have to cut you off if you don't let me do a little more talking. You are dominating the discussion, and I'm trying to address your points and your questions.
I'm dominating the discussion, really. I thought I was just finishing my sentence. But go ahead. Please do.
Have you ever heard the expression, "We're all from Adam"? We're all from Adam. We all came from Adam.
Sure.
So maybe all of us can claim to have had a heritage stemming from the Middle East. You know, the ancient Israelites, they didn't congeal into a nation overnight either. Yes, they do go way back. There's no denying that they have a historical or even a genetic connection to the Holy Land.
But they built a nation there. That's the difference.
That
There's
is not, history.
There's never been a Palestinian nation
that's
composed
not, Becky,
of an Arabic people.
I'm quite frankly, I'm very tired of hearing that argument, because that is not the crux of the argument. Whoever these people are, whatever they choose to call themselves, they are the indigenous people of Palestine.
Not.
And they there's
that is not true
we're not
at
talking
all.
We're not talking
not,
chromosomes.
Not demographically,
Becky,
not historically.
Becky, they are there. They were there.
Well,
their
why,
their
why
families
would you
have been
perpetuate a whole falsehood.
Becky,
like that?
If you're not listening, I'm going to have to say goodbye, because you keep interrupting me. Now please listen.
We're playing with falsehood. That's not an interruption.
Okay. Becky, I'm sorry. Perhaps I'll speak with you another time. You are indeed dominating the discussion. I had to say goodbye there, because I'm willing, certainly willing, obviously, in this format, to hear people's take on the subject, their experiences, and their opinions. This is a situation where my friend Becky, I say she's my friend, I've never met her, but this is someone who I happen to know has a bit of a reputation. I believe she was once affiliated with Free Radio Santa Cruz and did indeed have her own show at one time. But if she's not going to allow me to respond to more than a couple of points that she's making, I am the programmer here, and I don't care to hand this podium over to anyone else in the aggressive way that Becky was pursuing it. Yes, indeed, I have heard all the things that Becky has talked about, and when it gets to the point of denying that Palestinian Arabs, or whatever anyone wants to call them, are indigenous and giving, instead wanting to give that status to the Jewish people, for one thing, we are all from Adam. Secondly, that's pitting the reality on the ground, talking about Arabic peoples, largely of the Muslim faith, who have lived for many, many generations and many hundreds of years, going back well over 1,000 years. And even before that, before the time of Muhammad, as Arabs, they lived there. I don't care whether they call themselves Palestinian or not. My father referred to himself as a Palestinian. When I was a little boy, I kept hearing the word Palestine, Palestine. When Dad had guests in the house, or when we were in the company of others who found themselves curious about my father's origins, what his ethnicity was, he would say, and I really took this, my perception from my father was that he said with pride, I am from Palestine. He would say, Jerusalem in Palestine. Obviously wanting to differentiate the idea that he was from Jerusalem and Israel. My father certainly was not an Israeli. He specified in his American passport that he not be referred to as an Israeli. But again, this is semantics. I don't want to base an entire political discussion on the play of words. When you're talking about a real people who have lived for hundreds and hundreds of years in a land consistently, and you compare that to the genetic pool or the perhaps preferred chromosomes of the Jewish people, then I say, no, that is not a legitimate comparison. Trying to convince people that Jews are more indigenous by virtue of ancient lineage than are the people who actually live there today, and by today I mean for centuries, what you're really saying is that the Palestinians have no right to Palestine, or that the Arabs need to leave Palestine, and that tends to justify the expulsion of the Palestinian Arabs from historic Palestine. There have been a number of names applied to the area, certainly Israel, or Eretz Israel is in Hebrew, as the Israelis would say, the land of Israel. It has been called the land of the Levantine, or at least parts of it have. In the ancient Bible, the land is referred to as Canaan, and the ancient Philistines as Canaanites. But interestingly enough, if my friend Becky or anyone else out there wants to make the argument that the Jews were there first, if you really want to go all that way back in history and justify what the Jews have done to the Palestinians in the 20th and 21st centuries, well, I got news for you. The Philistines were there before the Israelis were. The Israelis emigrated, whether by choice or very strong influence, from Egypt into what their God told them was the promised land of milk and honey. This became known as the land of Israel to them, to that tradition, to that race of people, to that biblical and religious community. And there's no question that they did found a state as such. Now, not a state in the contemporary nation state sense that Israel exists today in terms of recognition from the world community, in terms of Geneva Conventions and all that. In fact, there are some fascinating material that I've read, most of them written by Jews, and most of them Israeli Jews, which go against the sense of purity of Jewish indigenousness to Palestine, which I wanted to read an article, I got it right in front of me, Toward a Real Archaeology and History of Palestine. Happens to be written by apparently an Arab professor at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, Bassem Al-Ra'ad. We got 6 minutes left in the program, folks, so I wasn't even able to to begin this article, but I promise I will read it in its entirety next Monday on Mideast Madness. But as I was saying, there are certain Jews have come forward. I don't think they're self-hating Jews. I don't think that they're not Jewish enough. Two favorite phrases of people who people use to dismiss the dissident Jews who are anti-Zionist or who want to shed some light on the subject. Fascinating material that suggests the that there's a lot of mythology involved with the labeling of Jewish people as indigenous, and that there's that it's by no means a cut and dried situation in terms of who really owns the land. As for myself, I say one of the most basic rules of thumb is possession is 9/10 of the law. Up until the end of the 19th century, the 1800s, there were Christians, there were some Jews who have been there apparently consistently, without interruption, since the days of the ancient Hebrew people, and there certainly have been Muslims. Yes, there's been a lot of warfare, and there have been dominations, military dominations by the Islamic people. But this was the norm for civilizations and societies since well before the birth of the Israeli people. I believe it was roughly the year 1312 before the Common Era, or 1312 B.C., now considered largely to be antiquated designations, B.C. It's before the Common Era. This is what they did. They basically mowed down the enemy. You look into any history book and you'll see the maps of the expansion of this empire and that empire. They were called empires for a reason. They had, you know, the Romans had superior weaponry because they knew how to forge iron, so they largely wiped out the Greek civilization, and then something else happened, and Roman Empire went down the tube, although I think that had a lot more to do with politics and religion. And, you know, whoever the toughest guy is on the block is going to take over, so to speak, and this includes, and I'm talking to you too, Becky, the ancient Israelites. They did not simply walk into the land of milk and honey. The historical record is they came in and slaughtered hundreds of Philistine people at a time. They came in as an emerging empire, and they entered Palestine. If, Becky, you are indeed a teacher, you need to do a lot more reading, and it needs to be far more objective reading than all this stuff that favors the existence and the history of the Hebrew people. Philistines, Arabs, all those so-called lesser people, as they're often viewed in the West, are not lesser human beings. They may lack a certain cultural or political sophistication. That's my opinion. They lack those things. But they are still people, and because they are not heralded in the history, in our history books, to the degree that others are, including the Jews, doesn't mean that they don't deserve a place in history. It certainly doesn't mean that they deserve to be treated as lesser people. I'm addressing this to all those Arabic governments, too, who oppress Baha'is. Baha'is in Iran suffered greatly following the return from Paris of the exiled Ayatollah Khomeini immediately after the 1979 revolution. Their towns and homes were burned. There was a great flight of Baha'is from Iran. This is shameful. This is unforgivable. There are oppressions throughout the Arab world, just as there are and have been oppressions throughout Latin America, Asia. Awful things happen, including far Southeast Asia and India, of course, and even in various communities in the United States. The American Indians, they've come a long way, but that's often measured in terms of assimilation. The American Indians are still not given a fair shake. They are the indigenous people of North America. The white man used the justification of manifest destiny, which is means, in their minds, the permission of God to take the land from the natives. Calling someone indigenous in real current day terms because they have a more distinct track of chromosomes going back to that time and giving them preference over the Arabs who have their own history in Palestine, regardless of what they call themselves or regardless of what anyone else calls themselves. Indigenous is indigenous. Okay, again, tune in next week at 3 o'clock when I will read this article by Mr. Raad entitled Toward a Real Archaeology and History of Palestine. It gets into some of the stuff that Becky and I were talking about. I do not feel entirely good about hanging up on Becky, but I tried to warn her a number of times, and I certainly tried to answer her questions, or at least give my opinions about things. Again, this is my podium. I pay the programmer's fee to do this show. And I hope I didn't scare off any other potential callers with what I did or the way I'm dealing with this situation. It does have to be a dialogue. I'm all for dialogue, and that is exactly why I encourage people to call in. This is Ren to Wheel. The show is Mideast Madness. Every Monday at 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time, soon to be Pacific Daylight Time again. It'll still be 3 o'clock. We run for almost 2 hours. And once I get this stuff set up, stay tuned for the next show, which will be International Middle East Media Presentation of Palestine Today. Thanks again. See you next week.
At the baseball park on Pigment Street, me and all my friends would meet. Some were fat and some were thin, but all of them had creamy skin. And I never saw an Asian, I never met a black. You really never noticed when you